As soon as the last vial is full, he turns and walks away. He imagines the children watching him go, in the branches, sitting in long lines with the smallest way up high so the bigger ones further down can keep them safe if anything fierce climbs up from the forest floor. It's nice, for a second, to imagine that phantom company. But the fact that he is still alive proves that he's all by himself out here after all. Part 3. Birth. Chapter 44. With the treads repaired and Greaves back on board, he did the job inside the 3 hours that Sixsmith predicted, with 5 minutes to spare. They continue south. Acting on the Colonel's orders, Sixsmith is aiming to pick up the main road again at Pitlochry. Once she is on tarmac, she will floor the accelerator. In the meantime, she coaxes Rosie with fretful patience over the rugged ground, giving the new tracks plenty of time to bed in. Outdistancing their pursuers will have to go on the to-do list for tomorrow. That's the bad news. The worst news is that the feral kids are still out there. Nobody sees them through the day, and everyone on board is starting to get their hopes up. But as soon as it starts to get dark, Foss dons the night vision goggles and dials the sensitivity up all the way. Abracadabra. The dusk is full of sprinting fairy lights. The children are behind Rosie and off to both sides of her, maintaining a wide, loose formation despite the rough terrain, effortlessly keeping up. The mood on board is volatile. That's a polite word for it anyway, Foss thinks. The robot's little trick with the track puller has bought him a little bit of leeway from the haters. The prevailing sentiment now is that when he locked them out, he was just panicking because Dr. Khan had been injured. Everyone except for McQueen seems prepared to accept that in mitigation, and even McQueen is on record as saying that the kid scores higher on a ball count than might have been expected. He hasn't forgotten the spiked radio, though. And he has told Foss privately that he is going to be the robot's shadow for the rest of the journey. Eyes on the prize all the way, until they get back to Beacon, drive in through the front gates and actually park. "There's something going on in there," he says, when Foss tries to joke him out of this promise. "I've only got a look at the kid's face." Which is true enough. But then there's something going on behind all of their faces. In Akimwe's case, it's grief, simple and bottomless. Foss had always assumed that he and Phillips were just shagging out of convenience and proximity, which goes to show how little she knows. Akimwe is down fathoms deep, and not coming up again soon. Fournier is sunk about the same distance, but his medium is self-pity, and, in Foss's opinion, terror. He stiffens at loud noises. His voice breaks unexpectedly when he's talking, and his eyes seem perpetually wet with unshed tears. It's just as well he spends most of his time in the engine room because he's a one-man funeral. McQueen is a ball of compacted rage. Khan is sleepwalking and looking for a way to wake up. The Colonel is... what? Waiting, maybe? Like he sees where all of the rest of them are heading, and he means to step along and join them in his own good time. Only Sixsmith seems to have her mind on her job, and given what her job is, that's just as well. The tracks won't slip again while she is at the wheel. At about 2100 hours, when they come down onto relatively level ground, Sixsmith puts the pedal down hard. This was a plan of the Colonel's. Take it slow and steady until dusk and then, conditions allowing, accelerate just as the kids are slowing down. It's too much to hope that Sixsmith will give them the slip altogether, but if she grabs some distance, she can put it to good use. About an hour later, the Colonel flags up a good defensible spot on a scree slope outside of Dunkeld, where they stop and dig in, properly. Motion sensors... razor wire barricades, anti-personnel mines, the whole shot. They are maybe 5 miles from where Burnham Wood made its unexpected visit to Dunsinane Castle in the play Macbeth, but there is no danger of that here. Carlyle has picked a spot with no ground cover for half a mile in any direction. Burnham Wood would need to put on a good turn of speed to get past Foss, who is up in the turret with the guns warmed up and ready. Of course, it's not trees she's looking to set light to. The colonel takes the midsection platform, despite having pulled double duty the night before. Tomorrow, they'll find the road again. Tonight, they'll sleep. Or in Dr. Fournier's case, catch up on some phone calls. He tries the brigadier's line again and again. It seems unlikely that she will pick up on the 100th hail after ignoring the 99 that came before, but he can't stop himself. He needs to explain to her that they're coming in. He has done all he can, and all that anyone could expect him to do, but they are coming in. Let the muster deal with Colonel Carlyle. It's the muster, after all, that has a problem with him. The doctor falls asleep at last, with the radio clutched in his hand, and wakes to find it whispering, vibrating in his grip. "Yes," he yelps, a little too loud. He winces at the sound of his own voice in the brittle silence. Pressing the radio to his lips, he murmurs, "It's me, Fournier." "You've been trying to reach me, Doctor?" The brigadier's voice is calm and cold. "Yes, since yesterday. There have been some developments. Things have happened that I have to report. We've lost Penny and Seely and Private Phillips in an engagement with Be Quiet." Fry stops him dead with those two words. Fournier's lips continue to move, but without any sound, without any breath. "I'll take your report later if there's time," Fry says. "The situation here has become..." There is an audible pause before she continues. "Unstable. The subversive elements in Beacon have managed to claim some territory and hold on to it. We're fighting on several fronts when we ought to be consolidating. Your losses are highly regrettable, but I don't have time right now to hear an itemized account." I understand," Fournier says. He thinks, unstable. What have they done to Beacon? What is happening back there? Meanwhile, Fry goes on without a break. "So my question for you is this, Dr. Fournier. Can you deliver the Rosalind Franklin to a specific location in a specific time frame?" Fournier is aghast. "No," he exclaims. "Definitely not. Brigadier, the chain of command has broken down here. Colonel Carlyle has threatened me, physically threatened me. He suspects I disabled the radio, and he's watching me all the time. He won't entertain any suggestion from me, not for a moment." Silence at the other end of the line, shot through with cycling static. "All right," Fry says at last, with grim resignation. "Explain." Fournier tries, but does poorly. The events of the previous day sprawl across his mind like debris from a landslide. He struggles to find a through line, and clearly he doesn't succeed. Fry seems confused about the children, and absolutely uninterested in Colonel Carlyle's threatening to murder him. She does take the point that they have encountered a new form of Hungary, and obtained an intact specimen. She congratulates him, perfunctorily, on that achievement, but she doesn't seem to appreciate what it might mean. When he tries to explain, the brigadier returns to something he told her during their last conversation. "You said there was some kind of personal friction between Carlyle and McQueen. Is that still true?" Fournier is nonplussed. "Well, yes," he says. "They came close to fighting yesterday. The colonel broke McQueen back down to the ranks after all. McQueen hasn't forgiven that." "Then let me talk to McQueen." Fournier thinks he must have misheard, so he ignores the order and goes back to his main theme. "The specimen is a child. It may have been born to an infected mother and its brain tissue later," Fry interrupts. "Your salient point is that you have new and pertinent data to bring home. That's excellent news, and you'll be rewarded in due course. But it's for others to examine and interpret. Right now, I need you to bring McQueen into the engine room and let me speak to him." so he did hear correctly. But after all these months of complete secrecy, he finds this shift in operating parameters hard to process. But then, if McQueen finds out I've been reporting to you... As ordered, the Brigadier reminds him. You've done nothing wrong. This is about Beacon's survival, and there is only one right side in that struggle. Bring him, Dr. Fournier, please. I assume he's still awake. I think they're all awake. I can hear them talking. They're in the crew quarters, most likely playing poker. Then go and fetch him. It's not as easy as it sounds. For once, the Colonel is in the midsection rather than in the cockpit, keeping watch along with Foss, so Fournier has to walk past him on his way to the crew quarters, eyes on the ground, unable to meet his gaze, and will have to walk past him again on his way back. He needs a plausible cover for a private conversation with the former lieutenant, and he can't think of anything that will not look suspicious. McQueen is not under his direct command. There just isn't any reason why he would need to talk to the man about anything that wouldn't normally route through Carlisle. And they're all so intent on their endless poker game that McQueen probably won't even listen to him. Inspiration strikes in the moment when he walks in on them. A diminished game, with just McQueen, Sixsmith and Akinwe at the table, and Akinwe there in body only, like a propped-up dummy. They don't look up. Until Fournier gathers the cards up from the table and holds out his hand for the ones they're holding. What the fuck? Sixsmith demands, bemused. I'm confiscating this deck of cards, Fournier says. It's bad for morale. And since they're still keeping tight hold of the cards in their hands, he turns and walks away with the bulk of the deck as his prize. Good night, Colonel, he mutters as he walks through the midsection. I hope we see no activity out there. He moves on quickly. If there is a reply, he doesn't hear it. He shuts himself in the engine room again and waits there in an agony of anticipation. Has he misjudged? He thought he knew McQueen well enough to be sure he wouldn't sit still for such a high-handed intervention. But they were all so beaten down in the wake of the attack that for once it might pass without comment. There is a knock on the door. A single peremptory thud. Then it opens and McQueen is standing in the gap. I'm going to need those cards, he says. His tone is grim, his face set in a warning scowl. Of course, Fournier says quickly, but come in and close the door. McQueen has come prepared to argue. He is not expecting instant surrender and he doesn't seem enthused by it. He beckons impatiently for the cards. Please, Fournier says. This is a really important matter. Lieutenant. His deliberate pause loads the last word with emphasis, and it does the job. McQueen steps inside, kicking the door shut with his heel. He tries for indifference, but with indifferent success. What? He says truculently. Fournier holds up the radio. Brigadier Fry, he says. Omitting what would have to be a lengthy and complicated explanation. She's calling from Beacon. She wants to talk to you. Surprise makes McQueen's normally forbidding face, for a moment or two, a perfect blank. He takes the radio, but stares at it as though he is not certain what to do with it. When he puts it to his ear, he does so warily with visible mistrust. McQueen, he says. Over. He listens in silence for a long time. Fournier listens too, but though he strains to hear, he gets no hint of what Brigadier Fry is saying. He is physically trembling with frustration and impatience when McQueen finally turns to him, covering the tiny radio with his big hand, as though it's the mouthpiece of a phone. She says to tell you this is private, he says, shrugging with his eyebrows as if to convey a shared exasperation with the vagaries of high-ranking officers. Sorry, you'll have to step out. Chapter 45 Stephen Greaves dreams about the scarred girl. In the dream she can talk, and she tells him about the life she lives with the other children. It's really nice, she says. We don't remember our mums and dads at all, Ever, and we don't need them. We've got each other. This sounds good to Greaves, but he is disconcerted to be having the conversation in the kitchen of the old house, where he lived with his mother and father until the day the Hungries came. It reminds him of what he has lost, when the girl is denying the reality of loss. Conflicting symbolism, some part of his mind comments. You want to believe, but you're telling yourself not to. Greaves leaves the thought parked in a storage bay somewhere behind or below the level of the dream. He thinks, behind, and then below. He needs to be clear about spatial relationships even in dreams, where space is purely abstract and notional. The kitchen is very fully realized, not abstract at all. His school bag stands on the table with Captain Power guarding it. His mother's last ever things-to-do list is pinned to the fridge with Magnet Homer and Magnet Marge. It says, Evacuation, 12 noon, library. I think you're all second generation, Greaves tells the scarred girl, children of the infected. So your mother had the pathogen in her system before you were born. You would never have known her as a human being. A human being is a very hard thing to be, the girl says gravely. Greaves agrees. But seriously, she tells him, come and live with us. Bring Dr. Khan. I can't do that. Greaves is sad to have to say it, but he knows it's true. I can't be like you, and neither can Rena. I'm absolutely sure you need to be exposed to the infection in utero in order to form the symbiotic attachment to the cordyceps fungus that you and the other children have. You're very clever, Stephen, the scarred girl says admiringly. Thank you. But then what's going to happen to Dr. Khan? As she says it, she points. Behind him. Greaves is meant to turn and see what she is pointing at. That's the way the dream is meant to work. When he resists it, when he refuses to move his head, something clamps down on his shoulder. A hand. Rena's hand. She is there, at his back, already changed, already gone from herself forever, sequestrated or erased by the infection. I don't want to see, he pleads. The girl nods. She understands. She gives him dispensation. You don't have to look if you don't want to, but you have to decide. You have to know what you're going to do. Rena's grip tightens on his shoulder. She can't think anymore, but clearly she agrees just the same. And then it comes to him that it's not Rena's hand that's gripping him. It's Rena's teeth. In an access of pure panic, he tries to pull away. If she infects him, if he becomes a Hungry, there won't be anybody who can save her. Losing him, she will lose herself. As his muscle tears between her tightening jaws, he wakes. His face is drenched with tears and his body with rank sweat. He is noxious and appalling to himself. If he went outside now, Hungries would flock to him like bees to a flower, like crows to the newly dead. He sits up. The crew quarters are absolutely silent. Without even opening his curtain, Greaves slides out and down. His bare feet touch the metal of the floor and he almost gasps at the shocking cold. He hates that he doesn't have any shoes on, but he is not prepared to take the risk of opening his locker. The less noise he makes, the less chance there is that he will be challenged and pressed with questions that he can't answer. By the light that filters in from the midsection platform, he retrieves the sampling kit from his bag. Then he moves on tiptoe to the door, clutching the plastic vials protectively against his chest. The platform seems to be empty, but as he moves across it, he sees the colonel sitting against the airlock door, his head bowed onto his chest. Greaves is about to say hello when someone hails him from above with an urgent, repeated click of the tongue. He looks up. It's Sixsmith manning the turret. Foss's watch is over, evidently, and she has taken the next stint. She points to the colonel. Let him sleep, she whispers. He was on his feet for 40 hours straight. Greaves nods to show that he understands. What's going on in there that couldn't wait until morning? Sixsmith demands in the same sotto voce. Never mind, don't tell me. But keep your voices down and close the bulkhead door. We're meant to be going dark. Stephen is passing these words as he steps into the lab, and one in particular. Voices, plural. Rena is standing at the workstation beside the freezer. Actually, she is leaning forward with both elbows on the bench. Her face is close up against the eyepiece of the TCM-400 inverted phase microscope, but her eyes, Greaves can see, are closed. They come open slowly as he pulls the bulkhead door across, and she turns to face him. She seems to have expected him, or at least she shows no surprise at his arrival. On Stephen's side, the surprise is absolute. He has come here to be alone, to do work that nobody else must see. And for a moment he mistakes the vials and jars on the bench in front of Rena for his own samples. But they're not. They're the last batch of legacy cultures from the Charles Darwin, the ones that Private McQueen and Private Phillips brought down from Ben McDewey the day before, back when Private Phillips was still alive, along with Dr. Seeley and Dr. Penny. So long ago. Rena comes away from the bench with a wince of pain or effort, and crosses to where Greaves is standing. In this constricted space, it only takes 4 steps. She stares into his eyes. Normally, she would know not to do that, would remember how hard it is for him to bear the searchlight beams of other people's gaze. Her own eyes are open very wide, the full circumference of each pupil clearly visible, and her irises are bigger than he has ever seen. They don't constrict at all, although the fluorescent tubes are very bright. Shadows like bruises underline them with savage emphasis, visible even on Rena's olive skin. "What did you do to me?" she asks him. The words come out low but forceful, with a growl of exhaled breath. She smells of sickness. Her breath is freighted with bile and medicine. "Rena," Stephen says, and for a moment that is all he can offer her. Her own name, like a badge, like an incantation to conjure her back into herself. She clutches at the lapels of his pyjamas and drags him close with surprising strength. "What did you do?" she repeats. Greaves is still struggling with the words, still not quite able to marshal them into a coherent sequence, but in any case Rena lets him go, as suddenly as she seized him. Her fingertips scrawl wavering lines down his chest as she turns away. Abruptly she sits down, in the middle of the floor. Her head sinks onto her clenched fists. "It wasn't you," she mutters. "I'm sorry. I shouldn't take it out on you. John is dead, and I don't feel enough. It's as though I'm a long way away from you all, from everything here. None of it is real." Greaves is filled with dismay. Rena is reporting altered effect, which probably means that the inoculation's effect is wearing off. He has to make up another batch of serum immediately, using the new tissue samples he took from the dead children after he repaired the treads. Also, he has to answer her questions. Holding back the truth, although he has done so recently with terrible effect, is for him like stopping a truck from rolling down a steep slope just with his hands. He dumps the sampling kit down on the workbench and starts to remove the individual containers from their receptacles. "It was," he says, quickly, running across a minefield made of words. "It was me, Rena. One of the children bit you and I had to stop you from changing. I gave you medicine I made out of the dead boy's cerebrospinal fluid. I came in here now to make some more." He holds up 2 of the sampling tubes, 1 in each hand, to show her. But Rena isn't looking at him. Her head is drooping at an odd angle on her neck, as though it is too heavy to hold up, and she is staring with wide-open eyes at her bandaged arm. The bandages dangle loosely. At some point she must have removed the dressing and looked inside. She must have seen the bite marks on her forearm. "Yes," she mutters at last. "I knew that, really. I just forgot." Memory lapses. Another warning sign. He has to do this now, and he has to do it right. He tells Rena the whole story as he works, in great haste to prepare another batch of the serum. He doesn't really believe she's listening. He's just throwing out the words in the hope of holding her there, her consciousness, her Rena-ness, for a few minutes longer. He throws out questions, too. Does she remember what happened after they got back inside Rosie? How he locked the door and how he pushed Dr. Fournier back into the engine room? You should have seen his face, Rena, he babbles. You would have laughed. It's only a guess. Not even that. It's something people say about strange and grotesque moments, when people act out of character or something unexpected happens. You should have seen their faces. He can't look at her face as he mixes and filters the live vaccine. He draws off 7 milliliters, which leaves about 25 in the retort. It's a slightly bigger dose than before, but with the ingredients in exactly the same ratio. What he did before worked. He can't afford the luxury of experimentation. Remembering the traumatic wrestling match that happened last time Greaves stays away from Rena's neck and injects instead into the medium cubital vein inside her left elbow, Rena helps, tapping the vein to make it dilate and protrude. That reassures him, but only for a moment. Does it mean she understands what he's doing, or is it only a muscle memory stimulated by the sight of the hypo? He kneels beside her and waits in a nightmare of anxiety for her to respond, to say or do something that will tell him whether she's still there with him or gone for good. His interior clock keeps time. He can't turn it off. For 17 desolate, drawn-out seconds, there is nothing. Then she reaches out and touches the back of his hand with the tip of her index finger. He lets out a held breath, trembling all over with relief. "Hey," Rena whispers weakly. "Stephen, when did you get here?" "Hey," Greaves answers. His voice thickens and he can get no further. Dr. Khan's head comes up slowly. Their eyes meet, only for a moment this time. She knows to look away at the moment when he starts to tense. But her fingertip presses harder against his skin. "I need a drink," she croaks. They can't go through to the crew quarters without passing under Sixsmith's gaze, and neither of them is ready to do that. Also, it would be impossible for them to talk in there. Rena has some instant coffee hidden away at the back of a shelf, a precious store that John found on one of the forays they made when they were heading north. She draws off water from one of the stowed drums into a beaker and heats it with a Bunsen burner. They sit side by side on the workbench, their legs dangling, and take alternate sips. It's too bitter and too hot. The only comfort it brings is from the fact of their sharing it. They talk in low voices. "So how did Alan react when you told him?" Rena asks.
"When I told him what?"
"Duh. What do you think?"
"About what you've made here, Stephen. About the..."
"I haven't told him." He steps in quickly. If she doesn't say it, doesn't use the word cure, he doesn't have to unsay it.
"Great. I want to be there when you do.
You know, I can't quite believe it.
I can't believe it was this easy.
My God, if John...
if he had just lived a day longer..."
She runs out of words, completes the thought with the smallest flexing of her hand. Greaves shakes his head. He's walking a tightrope over the abyss of an outright lie.
"It will take more than a day," he mumbles.
"You know what I mean," Rena says. She touches the back of his hand again for a moment, her emotions overflowing in a way that scares him.
"You succeeded where everyone else failed. I'm proud of you."
It's more than Greaves can bear.
"No, Rena, no," he says.
It sounds as though he's pleading. Perhaps he is. He pushes his clenched fist against his mouth to slow the words coming out, but he can't stop them.
"What do you mean, no?"
He is helpless in the grip of his compulsion.
"I didn't cure you," he whispers. "And I won't. I can't."
Chapter 46. With the first hint of light, when the air is still chill enough to use the enhanced mode on the glasses, Sixsmith takes a reading and declares that they're alone. McQueen doesn't really believe that, but he keeps up the pretense as they pack away the sensors and the traps, expecting at every moment to be caught in a cloudburst of slingshot stones and baby-faced monsters. The aim is to move out quick and quiet, to be on the road and up to speed before the feral kids know they're gone. That timetable hits a slight snag when Foss does a head count and discovers that Dr. Akimwe is no longer on board. McQueen is not in the least surprised. If he has ever seen a dead man walking, it was Akimwe, from the very moment he was told that Gary Phillips hadn't made it. None of the doctor's possessions are missing, but he has opened up the gun locker. Phillips must have given him the code, and removed one of the handguns. The DOS fucker hasn't taken any ammo, though, McQueen reports after a thorough check. The magazine ought to have been full, but after that he's on his own. Rosie's electronic log indicates that the passenger side cockpit door opened and closed again at 2:17 a.m. Sixsmith was still on watch in the turret and saw and heard nothing. There is yet another yakathon in the crew quarters, and they all get into a pointless shouting match over the odds of finding Akimwe if they turn around. They just won't. It's as simple as that. Not unless he sticks to the road. And if he intended to do that, there wouldn't be much point in sneaking away like a ninja in the first place. He's gone to bury Phillips, Sixsmith says. That's where we'll find him.
Yeah, but no, McQueen observes. He's not going to get that far.
For fuck's sake! Sixsmith is on her feet, glaring at him. 4 KIAs aren't enough for you. If we go slowly, we can pick him up with the infrareds. He can't have got far. But they will be driving back towards the children, and that's a bridge too far for all of them. When the colonel gives the order to keep on going south, nobody raises a squeak. Not even Sixsmith. McQueen guesses that she's just feeling bad because she let the doctor sneak out past her. Like it's on her somehow that Akimwe decided to kill himself. If they did manage to catch up with him, McQueen thinks, the first thing he personally would do is smack Akimwe in the head with a rifle butt for stealing the handgun. The handgun is actually useful. They get moving at last. The atmosphere on board is as tense as hell. It feels to McQueen as though they're all counting odds, all except for him, anyway. What he is doing is brooding over an imaginary Venn diagram entitled, "My enemy's enemy is my friend." Brigadier Fry has promised to give him back his commission if he will help her with a little problem, the problem in question being Colonel Isaac Carlyle. There is absolutely no downside to dropping the colonel in a bathtub full of broken glass. But conspiracies, cabals, other people's agendas, it all sticks in McQueen's throat a little and makes him want to bulk. He'd rather just go round and round with the colonel on a little patch of grass somewhere. Hand him a split lip, a few broken ribs, maybe the odd tooth. Shepherd him to a few conclusions about human dignity. But that's not going to happen. And if Beacon is going all to pieces, with the Brigadier doing the carving, he will need to find a place to stand. Might as well pick the one that comes with the fringe benefit of the Colonel getting his ticket punched. They're all as bad as each other, in his opinion. But the Colonel is the only one McQueen ever had some respect for, and therefore the only one who has ever disappointed him. He has this coming. He goes to Carlyle in the cockpit and asks for permission to speak in private, with a pointed sideways glance at Sixsmith in the driving seat. They go astern, all the way to the lab. Nobody is working there. The colonel closes the door and waits for McQueen to speak. McQueen puts Fournier's little radio down on the workbench. Carlyle stares at it, a slow frown descending over his face. "Whose?" he says. He knows what he's looking at, and probably he has guessed right away what it means. "Fournier's. It's a one-to-one, permanently welded to a single freak. In case you're wondering who's on the other end, it's Brigadier Fry." Carlyle nods, accepting the explanation without question. "Because why not? It makes so much sense." "And how did you come by it?"
he asks McQueen. Heard him talking, walked in on him. He spilled it all without me even asking. Fry wanted someone to keep an eye on us out here, playing the political game, some such fuckery. I suppose she picked Fornio because she knew he'd roll over when he was told to. He wasn't ever going to say no. Carlyle picks the radio up at last. It's still functional? McQueen nods. I didn't talk to Fry, but I could hear an adjutant repeating a call sign for a couple of minutes after I took it away from Fournier. This is looking good. The old sod is buying the whole prospectus. It's not as though he has a lot of choice at this point. The radio is a big deal, no matter how you look at it. A lifeline. They were lost, and now they're found. Carlyle can't do anything but take it and use it. McQueen waits. The colonel says nothing. Might have bruised the doctor a little in passing, McQueen offers. I hope I'm not on a charge or anything. He really didn't want to let go. Carlyle looks at him hard, really searches his face. McQueen endures the scrutiny, deadpan to a fault. Yeah, you're very welcome, he says at last, to break the heavy silence. Carlyle doesn't even say dismissed. He just pockets the radio and walks back to the cockpit, turns his back on McQueen like McQueen isn't even there. Oh, shit. Does he have this coming? On his way through the crew quarters, Carlyle has time to notice how quiet things are. Not a good quiet, an enervated one. Foss is lying in her bunk with an arm thrown across her eyes, too exhausted even to sleep. Stephen Greaves sits at the table with his arms in his lap, staring at nothing. Samrina Khan is in the galley area, gripping the countertop on either side of the sink, head down as though she's about to throw up, or else just has. The colonel is perturbed about the radio, and even more so about McQueen. He has always been reasonably skilled in the assessment of character, but there is something in McQueen that is opaque to him. Perhaps he has allowed some mistrust to take root in his mind for that reason alone, quite apart from his doubts about the man's fitness as a soldier. But finding the radio was a good thing, and handing it over was a better one. The radio. It's a godsend, but Carlyle strongly dislikes what it implies. When he takes his seat next to Sixsmith, when he sets the small device down on the cockpit's console, he feels as though he has picked up a great weight, rather than shedding an insignificant one. Sixsmith is staring at the radio in wonder. "Where the bloody hell did that come from?" she demands. "A contribution from Dr. Fournier," the colonel observes, keeping his tone carefully neutral. There is no point in letting his anger show, no point in feeling it, although that ship has already sailed. There has never been trust between himself and the Brigadier. When he tried to resign his commission, the most passive of protests, she read it as open rebellion and argued him out of it. She has been afraid ever since that he will attack her again from a different direction. And he has felt close, recently, to doing it. That was why Fry sent him away. But clearly sending him away wasn't enough. "Dr. Fournier," Sixsmith repeats, making the name sound like a swear word. Apparently this was issued to him when we left Beacon, as a fallback in case of emergency. I think our current circumstances qualify. There's no more to be said on that topic. No more at least that Carlyle can trust himself to say. "I'm going to call Beacon, Private," he tells Sixsmith. "If I get through, I may need your help in maintaining the contact. This is a very small and very directional device. If we start to lose signal strength, please slow the vehicle and be prepared to stop if I tell you to." Sixsmith shoots him a look, freighted with unspoken questions. "Yes, sir." Carlyle switches on the radio and waits. There is almost no static, just a low hum of electronics. After a while, a male voice speaks. "Brigadier Fry's field line." "This is Colonel Carlyle," the colonel says. "I'd like to speak with the Brigadier if she's available." There is no pause at all, and no surprise in the man's voice. "Yes, Colonel, one moment." "They were expecting me," Carlyle thinks. Most likely the doctor missed a scheduled call-in and they drew their own conclusions. Isaac. Fry's voice this time. And although she sounds weary and stressed, she makes more of a performance out of being caught unawares. How did you find this frequency? I don't recall giving it to you. I'm calling you on Dr. Fournier's radio, Brigadier. He doesn't offer an explanation, but moves straight to the substance of his report. We're now heading south towards the northern end of the M1 and making good speed. But there have been developments of the utmost significance of which you and the whole of the main table need to be apprised. Go ahead, Fry says. He doesn't waste words. First he details Greaves's find, because that's the nub of the matter. They are carrying a specimen that is absolutely unique, and whose scientific importance cannot be overstated. A child who seems to have a partial immunity to the hungry pathogen. A child whose remains might hold the key to a cure. Only after that does he fill in the details about the botched search party and the deaths. He states, formally, and for the record, that he is taking full responsibility for these things. Finally, he makes it clear that Rosie is running for home, non-negotiably, and that she might not be alone when she arrives. When he has finished speaking, there is a long silence. To his right, and at the periphery of his vision, Private Sixsmith's hands grip the wheel more tightly than is strictly necessary. So, after 7 months of nothing to report, Brigadier Fry says at last, you're now saying that you may have made a definitive breakthrough. Her tone is clinical, with no trace of enthusiasm or curiosity. Yes, exactly. The timing is interesting, Isaac. I might almost be tempted to say suspicious. Carlyle is baffled, both by the words and by the coldly accusing way in which they're spoken. Suspicious, he repeats. I don't understand, Brigadier. What is it that you suspect? Another silence. It's not important, Fry says at last. I'll consider what needs to be done. Keep the radio open on this frequency. This last instruction is meaningless, since the little radio lacks a tuner. Lutz might have been able to tweak it onto another frequency using parts from the main cockpit radio, but nobody else on board would have a clue how to do that. But the dead air from the radio makes it clear that Fry has signed off. Evidently, Sixsmith feels free now to draw the moral. So, Dr. Fournier has been spying on us all ever since we hit the road. Beacon was at liberty to set up multiple reporting systems, Carlyle says carefully, mechanically defending the status quo. Why does he do that? Why has he spent his whole life servicing and sanctioning bad decisions made by people he can only despise? He lets out a breath that turns out to be a sigh. Yes, he admits, Dr. Fournier has been filing secret reports to the muster. Although he's meant to be civilian commander. I'll make an official complaint on our return to Beacon. How about an unofficial smack in the face? Sixsmith's tone is tight, and the colonel doesn't believe she is joking. Private, he says, it's not worth risking a reprimand or a dishonourable discharge over... Fry's voice cuts him off. The channel is open again and might have been all along. I've arranged an escort for you, the brigadier says without preamble. It's of the utmost importance that your specimen is taken back to Beacon for further study, and the Rosalind Franklin alone is too vulnerable to attack. Very well, Carlyle says. What are your orders? Rendezvous at base Hotel Echo, near Bedford, 48 hours from now. If you're going to have trouble making that rendezvous, let me know well in advance. I'm not familiar with Hotel Echo, Carlyle admits. There's no reason why you should be, Colonel. It doesn't exist yet. It's the former RAF Henlow. We're refitting it as a forward base for tech retrieval runs into Stevenage and Milton Keynes. Take down the coordinates. Carlyle does. The Brigadier goes on to give him more detailed instructions for the rendezvous. She will arrange for a squad of 20 soldiers to be present, along with 3 armoured vehicles, all under the command of a Captain Manolis. If they are not present, Carlyle is simply to wait. On no account is he to use the radio, either to speak to the Brigadier herself or to attempt to make contact with anyone else at Beacon. When Captain Manolis makes himself known, Carlyle will turn Rosie over to him and ride in a staff car to Beacon, ahead of the rest of the column for immediate debriefing. Carlyle believes he knows what debriefing will entail in this context. Despite their revolutionary discovery, the expedition has sustained unacceptable losses, and by military logic, someone has to be to blame. He will take that blame, while Fournier takes the credit for the new specimen. Probably this, or something like it, has been the plan all along, from before they even left Beacon. Possibly the only purpose of the expedition in the Brigadier's mind was to allow Carlyle a public opportunity to fail. Fry is still talking him through the protocols for the rendezvous. Assuming the absence of Hungries, she tells the Colonel, he and his people are to exit Rosie first, bringing the specimen with them and assemble on Base Hotel Echo's main parade ground. Manolis and his squad will then make themselves known, retrieve the specimen, and carry out a handover in good order. Fry asks Carlyle to confirm and accept these orders. He does, but he feels compelled to add something despite Sixsmith's presence beside him. You should have trusted me, Geraldine. I've never given you any reason to question my loyalty to Beacon or to the Muster. Well, Fry says. The word hangs by itself for a moment. Loyalty is just the wheels on the bus, Isaac.
Meaning what?
Meaning that it keeps things moving, but it's neutral when it comes to the direction they move in. The Colonel contains a twinge of exasperation. I believe that's actually the point I was making. I've been neutral to a degree that could barely be called pathological. Yet you decided you needed eyes on me all the same. Can I ask why that is? There is a pause filled only with static. We've missed you, Isaac, the Brigadier says. I look forward to hearing all about your adventures north of the border. She cuts the channel. He knows the answer to his question in any case. Fry is a political animal, engaged perpetually in a zero-sum game. She plays it skillfully, in all circumstances, and she has an unerring sense of the cards that other people are holding. As she has consolidated her hold on power, Carlyle has been almost the only muster officer with the combination of high profile and public approval to challenge her. She has never stopped waiting for him to play out the hand. The Colonel stares out of the forward windscreen. The road opens ahead of them miraculously clear. They are making good progress for the first time since they rolled out of Invercrae. But where are they going? Chapter 47. In the crew quarters, Dr. Khan is falling. Her hands are braced against the edge of the sink, her feet firmly planted on the steel plates of Rosie's floor, but all the same she is in free fall. She's been like this for hours, ever since she spoke to Stephen in the lab, and she still hasn't hit bottom. Perhaps there is no bottom. Lieutenant Foss mutters in her sleep, something about roast chicken, something about time. Khan plummets through the diffuse froth of the lieutenant's voice without slowing. They're going home. But that's not real. John is dead, which is just about as real as it gets, but even that is just a fact she has to remind herself of every few minutes, to keep her grieving fresh. The road is going to get bumpy, Sixsmith calls from the cockpit. In the absence of the intercom, she has to rely on her own natural bellow. There's a heap of old cars ahead, but they're mostly just rust and moss. I think they'll pretty much break apart when we hit them, but you'll feel a jolt. Hold on tight. Khan holds on tight. It makes no difference. Rena, Stephen says at her elbow, you better strap in. The baby. The baby, yes. All right. She slows herself, opens her eyes on a present moment where she desperately wants not to be. A fierceness rises in her, ballasts her. She pulls herself together, brings herself, by the application of her will, to a dead halt, although Rosie rumbles on. The baby needs her to make rational decisions about her own safety, since her safety ensures its own. She crosses to a chair, hands cradling her swollen belly, sits down, straps in. Stephen takes the seat beside her and checks the straps, making sure that they're not crossed or twisted, and that the inertia reel is running free. Sixsmith's warning has woken Foss, but she just turns over in the bunk and digs in out of sight.
"Lieutenant Foss," Stephen calls out, "we need to..."
"I'll take my chances," Foss grunts. Rosie shudders and rocks. The deck plates creak. They're flung from side to side by sudden shifts, lurches, stops and starts. Khan stares straight ahead, braced tight in her chair. "It's not a cure," Stephen had said, in the lab when they spoke before. "I know what the cure will look like, but I didn't have the time to make it. All I could do was stabilize you in a sort of brute force way. The feral children secrete their own neurotransmitters that talk back to the fungus, and now your brain has those chemicals too. Cordyceps thinks you're a friend. Cordyceps thinks you're all part of one big fungal colony." "But that is a cure," Khan whispered. In her desperation, she had held onto his sleeve, almost touching him, almost invading him. "That's the definition of a cure, Stephen. A way to keep the pathogen from changing us. It's what we've been looking for all along. It's enough. Isn't it enough?"
"No. Yes. Maybe, if there was enough medicine. But there won't be. Even for her, he won't keep making it. He'll keep her stabilized until the birth, until the life inside her has undocked. That will use up all the serum he has on hand, and he won't go hunting for fresh ingredients, not given where they would have to come from. Which is to say, the brains and spinal columns of the feral children. He won't commit murder for her." When he told her that, and when she realized that her life as a human being was measurable in days or perhaps in hours, she felt herself fall. She fell away from him and Rosie and her stolid, helpless self, from everything that demanded an answer out of her. Such a luxury. Such a mountain of self-pity. She hates herself for having that traitor inside her, that coward. She is back now. In the driving seat, whatever that might mean. She will see this through for the baby's sake, given that as of now she has no sake of her own. It helps to think of herself as a vessel, like Rosie, carrying a precious cargo over rough terrain, heading for a harbour where most likely, having served her purpose, she will be mothballed and dismantled. There is no shame in that. No stigma in being dead once you've done everything you needed to do. She has this payload to deliver. She needs to keep her armor up until the job is finished. A sudden clenching of her stomach promises that the job will be finished soon. What if she outed him? Shouted out Stephen's secret to the rest of the crew. McQueen would get the recipe out of him at the point of a bayonet, squeeze him like a sponge. The world would be saved. But no, it wouldn't. The treatment seems to require regular top-ups, like the TD toxoid vaccine for tetanus. Khan glimpses a future in which the feral children are caught, brought to maturity, bred in pens the way pigs and sheep used to be before the breakdown, farmed for their nerve tissue. "How many lives is my life worth?" she wonders, dazed and sickened. She can't do the maths. While the baby is still inside her, she won't even try. But she'll keep her mouth shut as they rush towards separation. What happens after that will depend on who she is when they get there. Chapter 48. Night falls and they keep on moving. Slowly, with circumspection but always pushing forward. It's a calculated risk. The road is wide and flat, and they can see a long way out in front of them. This far north, the obstacles are few,
and since Sixsmith has charted them on their way up, she is unlikely to be surprised. With the first hint of dawn, she accelerates again. Rosie attains her ponderous top speed and eats up the miles. Hungries see them and give chase, not the children, just the regular kind. But mostly they don't get close. When they do, Rosie ploughs them under with a barely perceptible bump. They are still 2 days out of Beacon by anybody's reckoning, but they're not heading for Beacon now. If they keep to this speed, they've got one more day, one more night. They'll make it to the rendezvous sometime around sunup tomorrow. There has been talk of helicopter gunships. They will ride home in style, leaving Rosie behind them like a steel rind, a shed skin. That thought causes Lieutenant Foss a twinge of melancholy, but in every other respect the news is good. She has had more than enough of the field. She wants a hot bath, a sweaty fuck, these thoughts are not coming in any kind of logical sequence, and above all the feeling that if she lets her guard down nothing will take a bite out of her. This is what she's living for now, and it's close enough that the pleasant fantasies she is indulging feel like promises to herself that she can actually keep. Looking around her, though, she's not seeing the same enthusiasm. Okay, the white coats are in mourning, she gets that, and she respects it. But the Colonel isn't saying a word to anyone. Sixsmith is sullen, and even McQueen has closed up tighter than a nun's hope chest. She finds him in the midsection making ammunition. It's something she does herself, but she has never seen him take an interest. The RIH cartridges and vintage Lapua Magnums that Beacon uses as standard issue seem to suit him well enough, and he hasn't seemed impressed by her highly technical arguments about long-range stopping power versus short-range accuracy. Now he's sitting there on the floor with a non-electric press and a Lee Challenger reloader. She is pretty sure it's hers, cleaning out spent primers with the quiet intensity of a monk flicking through the best bits of his rosary. "You pick your times," Foss says, nudging his shoulder with her knee. "What do you think you're going to be shooting?" "You never know," McQueen says. He doesn't look up from his work. Foss leans back against the turret rail and watches the landscape roll on by. She feels a strong determination to squeeze a companionable moment out of this. "Remember that time on the way up when we got stuck in the mud and had to hammer the front winch into the fucking asphalt because there was nothing else to tie it to?" McQueen tamps another primer down, decants powder into the Challenger's narrow hopper. "What about it?" "Nothing. I'm just looking forward to never doing it again, that's all." No response. "What are you looking forward to?" Foss prompts. He looks up at her now, his eyes cold. "Some peace and quiet," he says. Foss can take a hint. "Fine," she says. "Enjoy." She leaves him to his home maids, which frankly are not up to the standard of hers. He is sloppy with the calipers and uneven with the powder. The crew quarters feel uncomfortably empty, like a jawline with some fresh, raw gaps between the teeth. Khan is lying down, her pale face shiny with sweat. The robot is soaking a towel at the sink which he carries across to her. She is clutching her big belly and muttering to herself under her breath. Counting, it sounds like. Foss puts two and two together and gets a total of holy shit. "You're kidding me," she says. "It's coming. It's coming now." "Soon," Greaves says, giving Foss a quick, anguished glance. "The contractions are 15 minutes apart." Khan says nothing. Her eyes are open and she's staring at the ceiling. She is deep inside herself somewhere, barely aware of her surroundings. "Okay," Foss says. "But what the hell does that mean? Should she do something or just let this run its course? What's the significance of 15 minutes apart? How long does that give them?" The last question is a pertinent one. "Khan," she says, "are you about to drop? Give me an ETA, for the love of Christ." "It could be a few hours yet," the robot tells her. "When she's fully dilated, the contractions will come a lot faster.
and probably her waters will break.
Still nothing from Khan, not even a look. Foss turns her attention back to Greaves.
Can you do the necessary? She asks him.